It's 7:15. We're going to start the AES portion of our meeting. Thank you for coming. So I want that on the internet, but not in the room. And we are using the first, this is the first time we've used this software to provide both a webinar and a meeting, and you get to benefit from seeing that. We've done a bunch of dry runs, but this is the first time for real. So first of all, welcome. I'm Dan Mortensen. I'm the chair of the Audio Engineering Society Pacific Northwest section, which is the one around here. And this is the last meeting of our season, and we're thrilled that it's going to be such a neat one, and I think you're in for a treat, but I would since I put it together. So, first, let's make sure everybody has a seat who wants a seat. Anybody missing? I see one here, there's one there, a couple back there. So if more people come in, could you guys please steer them in? The format of the evening here is the first 15 minutes or so, we've got an AES election to do for our officers and committee, half of our committee for next year. And that's only for AES members, and the rest of you get to see the astonishing ritual and so forth for that. So and I'm going to make a personal request to our AES members, even though there is a mechanism for nominations from the floor at this meeting, there's been nominations out for a month now, and I would have hoped that anybody who was running would have contacted us by now. So in the interests of making this evening go smoother and straightforwardly, I would personally appreciate it if you would run next year instead of this year, if you haven't already declared that you're going to run. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Bob Smith, who's going to conduct the election. And you don't have a microphone, so let's give you one
That's
of these.
Okay, I can talk loud.
Okay, Bob will talk loud.
First off, how many AES members do we have here? Raise your hands.
Okay, let me count it, and then every one of them gets a ballot. Okay?
We'll see.
Let's hold off with the ballots.
Oh,
just
okay.
Count them. Do the count first.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 15, 14, 15, 16, 17. Looks like 17, so we have a quorum.
Okay. Dan?
Yes.
Do you have the ballot that you could show on the screen here?
Maybe.
Did I give that to you?
You did, but can I go to it immediately? The ballot is in.
Right there.
We may not use those.
We'll just see three. So first, there's people running for officers. We have Dave Tosky-Lane, the chair, Steve Mallett for vice chair, Gary Lee for secretary, and Dave Francois for treasurer. Okay, if you scroll that up a little bit. And we have James Johnson running for committee. There's five committee positions open, and we have five people applying for them. I'll explain the extra one later. Greg Mauser, Mark Rogers, Yvonne Paget, and Rich Williams are running for the five committee positions. Rick Chin vacated his chair to become a member at large. And anybody wants to know the details around that, what he gets to do, basically does everything else. He's just making a spot available. But Dan's going to run for it, Phil, for a year. So we get to continue to have Rick's expertise helping us in all of our committee work, which he does a wonderful job of. He just doesn't do Windows. Okay, so those are the people nominating, and you heard what Dan had to say, but procedurally, I need to open the floor for nominations. So they're now open for nominations. JJ?
I move to accept the ballot by acclamation.
Okay, there's been a motion to accept the ballot by acclamation. Do I have a second?
Second.
It's been seconded. Okay, all in favor of electing the candidates as you see on the ballot, raise your hands. Anybody opposed? Raise yours. Okay, I declare the candidates elected by acclamation, and this election is concluded.
Nice.
Was that awe-inspiring or what? I want to ask you. Okay, so we are going to continue momentarily with our slideshow of New York while I get Frank. Oh, shoot, we're back to the beginning. Well, anyway. So what you're viewing now and will for the next few minutes while I'm wheeling stuff past is this exact one is the Stork Club. And this is New York City and specifically Manhattan while Frank was active there. And that's what you've been watching up until this moment as well. So we're going to get situated here. And Bob, if you want to bring the music up and if you want to visit amongst yourselves for a couple minutes, we'll be ready. And then we'll do a big unveil of our special guest. So. No. Okay, you hear me now, right? You're hearing me now, right? Yeah, okay. Good. Right. You won't be able to see him. He's just in your ears. Yeah. Okay. All right. We might as well start here. Is that Jack in the back? There's seats down here. Raise your hand if you've got a seat next to you. There's some seats over here. Okay, good. Let's kill the music, please. Well, let's get everybody seated before we start. Who wants to sit? And then we're going to turn the lights off so that it'll be more exciting that way.
Exciting.
All right. Welcome again, everybody. And thank you for coming. Go ahead, Dave. There you go. So we're going to take a closer look at the CBS 30th Street studio in New York City with our guest here, Frank Laco. And I think that deserves some applause. And also, I hope on the phone are David Simons, author of Studio Stories. You there, Dave?
How are you?
All good.
Can you hear me?
Excellent.
All right.
And Steve Epstein, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good evening.
All right. All right, it works. So those guys are both on the East Coast and staying up very late, and we appreciate that a lot. And I think we're ready to go. Are we ready to go, Bob? Oh, and welcome to people on the Internet who are watching this wherever you might be. I don't have a way to know who you are or where you are, but I know you're there, and thanks a lot for doing this. As I've said many times, you're not going to see the movies or hear the audio as well as we are seeing and hearing them here, but as my friend Orica Hayes said about Internet audio many years ago, you should not pay close attention to the fact that the dog is singing out a tune. You should be amazed that the dog is singing at all. And I think that's an appropriate thing for Internet audio. They're getting my desktop. Okay, Lars is in the room monitoring this, so excuse me. Oh, yes. Okay. Thank you. I'd shut that off for a while, and now I have it back on. So, Lars, are you getting that?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that, folks. And if we have Internet issues, Lars will stop and talk to us, and we can all be an exciting part of the world of audio. Of the Internet. And Roxanne, before you go here, I wanted to first thank our host, Roxanne from Krista, who's in the doorway there, for making this space and all the food and cookies and stuff available to us.
It's a pleasure to have you. Thank you for sharing with us.
Well, it's a pleasure for us. And I also want to thank the residents of the facility who are here visiting us. I see you when I come visit Frank, and it's really a treat having you here, so thank you. The evening is going to be in roughly two parts. The first part will go till about 8:30, and then we'll have an intermission where you can have cookies and treats and stuff, and then we'll come back and have a couple of door prizes for you to draw from the sheet that you filled out at the gate as you came in. That's how we'll do the drawing. And now we will continue with our program. So if you were at 207 East 30th Street in New York City in Manhattan, this is the building that you would see up until about 30 years ago. And if you were to go in it, this is what you would be hearing. Bob? Wasn't our medley, was it?
We forgot it.
Okay, so so that was one thing that you would have heard had you been in there. There's a whole bunch of other great stuff that was recorded there, and we're going to show you part of it tonight. If you go to Wikipedia and look up the CBS 30th Street Studio, and you actually do need to enter CBS 30th Street Studio. If you enter 30th Street Studio, you get zilch. But it was nicknamed the church. It was from 49 to 81, or maybe 82.
82.
82. There's some examples of the people that were there: Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, Percy Faith's Theme from a Summer Place. The site was originally the Adams Parkhurst Memorial Presbyterian Church, a mission of the Madison Square Presbyterian Church designed by the architect J. Cleveland Cady, and was dedicated in 1875. If you look up J. Cleveland Cady, also on Wikipedia, you'll see down below here that he was the architect of the original Metropolitan Opera, which was opened after the 30th Street, after the church, in 1883. So you've got to figure that some of the skill and ability that he had in designing acoustics that he maybe figured out during the church was used to design the Metropolitan Opera. And if you went in the Metropolitan Opera, this is the interior in 1937. The original was lost in a fire in about 1905 or so, but this was rebuilt, and the original must have looked similar to this. So that's a pretty impressive space. The reason that it's called the Adams Parkhurst Church is discussed in this book from 1906, written by Reverend Charles Parkhurst, who was a prominent clergyman in the Presbyterian Church then. And the relevant part here is the cornerstone of the new chapel was laid by Reverend William Adams with appropriate services September 14, 1874, and dedicated on Easter Sunday in 1875. The building and foundation cost about $60,000 and the land $15,000. So for $75,000 in 1873 dollars, they were able to build this pretty incredible space. Now, it didn't look like what we saw in the 30, 40s and 50s and 60s. This is a rather poor reproduction of a picture in that book, 1906 book. And you can see that it's got these two giant steeples on it. And if you look on some other pictures that we found, this one was on Jim Reeves' website, and I want to tell you about that for just a second. He is he worked at the 30th Street Studio for some years in the 70s and has a website now where he keeps track of, he has some vintage sessions listed as part of his website. And I found this picture first on there, and this was taken in the 30s. You can see the Empire State Building there without its mast. Empire State Building was made dedicated in 1930, and these cars are roughly 30s cars. And over here you can see the 3rd Street, 3rd Avenue L, which was torn down in 60-something, I think. Does that sound right? Yeah. So a very different look to that space. And here's a later picture also from Jim Reeves' website. And Steve, you had something to say about this picture when we were talking earlier.
Yeah, in 1940, New York City had tax departments sent out a bunch of photographers to photograph properties in all the five boroughs. And I lived in Queens in the late 50s and 60s, and I found a picture that had exactly the same thing that you're seeing there, that 911-8-M. Mine had a Q because it was Queens, and of course a different number. So that would take this at 1940.
And you can see that this is something sitting in the street. It's got these wires holding the thing up for stability so the wind didn't blow it over. But it's amazing to see this thing with these giant towers. And then somehow between when those pictures were taken and when CBS got it here. So, Frank, do you have any recollection of how that occurred? And when did CBS take this place over?
If I remember, we took that space 49. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong. But
no, you're right.
And then,
who was behind that? Who made the approval of being able to do this? Who agreed to do this?
Prior to this, CBS Press started to look for recording studio. And on the TV line, these photos were flashed. And I finally thought, well, it's a good street, looks quiet, it's a family street. So they put in a bid. And they got it.
And they already had several studios, but they were not big. They were not big studios, were they?
No, they were radio.
Radio studios, yeah. Uh-huh. And the guy that was involved in doing this, who's this guy? Yeah, Mitch. I hear people saying it in the audience. He was an exuberant guy. You don't see pictures of him that are much different than this one.
Yeah.
So his deal when they got it was that they would accept. He would accept this studio, and he talked to you guys, as I recall you saying.
Yes.
And then to get the approval of the sound of it. And I'm going to blow it up just a little bit here, but you see these paint splotches on the wall and patches and stuff. And his big deal was that nobody would ever wash the floors or paint the walls or do any kind of remodeling. And it stayed the way it was. They wouldn't move any of the curtains. The curtains that are on the walls were the exact ones that were there when they moved in. And as long as they did that, the sound of the room would stay the same. And so the CBS Brass agreed to do that. And the studio was as is for quite a while. And here's another great picture of Mitch. Do you guys recognize that guy with him? Satchmo. What a great look on Mitch's face in that one, man. So here's a guy that we know and love. And this is before your stint at 30th Street.
Yes.
This is 1940 at 799, I think.
Right. 799.
So this is before you went off to war. Off into the army.
Yes.
And this is Frank, yeah? And he was there, he was working for World Broadcasting at the time, and World Broadcasting would hire him out to CBS Records for various projects. You have to include this picture because it's such a great one in anything, even though it's not at 30th Street. And then here's an even better one that's after he came back from the war. And this was on that great poster that Roxanne made here. Post. This is also at 799, so it's a little different situation. But in the other presentations that we've done with Frank, let me get this thing blown up here and moved over. This is why people loved working with him, was the great attitude and his happy demeanor. There you go. Now, they got the 30th Street studio, and this is the interior of it. This is not a session that Frank did. This is Glenn Gould at the piano trying out four different pianos. But it shows you, it gives you an example of the space of this place. It's a pretty large place. Do you remember how big it was?
100 by 100 by 100.
Yeah.
Big?
That's big. That's a big space. And
it was.
You could not only fit four grand pianos in it, you could fit a symphony orchestra in it. And this is Igor Stravinsky. Stravinsky or Sikowski? I get those backwards all the time.
Stravinsky,
okay. Conducting an orchestra. And that looks pretty full. Well, here's Leonard Bernstein conducting an orchestra. That looks pretty full. Here's Leonard Bernstein conducting an orchestra from afar with a chorus, and there's still a lot of room in this studio. It was a nice big space, and you can see it's got high ceilings. And we'll continue. Actually, before I do that, I wanted to say that the eras of the studio for tonight's purposes, we're going to break up into basically three groups. There's the old control room, which is this one. This funny U-shaped window is really unique. You don't see that anywhere else that I've ever seen before. Maybe you've seen it before someplace, but you can always tell what era the pictures are in if you can see the control room, because the original control room had a U-shaped window and it was a raised floor. See how these guys are standing up at the back and it's still higher. So to get up to that control room, you had to go up a flight of stairs to get there. And we'll hear more about that later, because that kind of caused some problems. Then there was the new control room, and I'll show you that later too. And then there was the modern era, I guess, which frankly I just learned about last weekend, and you'll hear how that came about, but it's pretty amazing. So anyway, we divided it up into three, and so there's definite time periods involved. The old control room is from its opening until about 1961-ish maybe, and we're not quite sure about that. The new control room is from whenever that changeover was until about 1970-something. And then the modern control room was until it ended in 82. Okay, so we're going to continue on. And we're going to listen to, tonight we're going to listen to five pieces of music that were done at 30th Street. Most of them Frank recorded. They were all chosen to familiarize you a little bit, as much as we can in this brief time we have together, with what the studio sounded like and what it was capable of doing. The first one we're going to play is from Miles Davis' Porgy and Bess album, with Gil Evans, the conductor and orchestrator. And this is the track, It Ain't Necessarily So. And we're just going to play excerpts of these tracks for you, but you'll get an idea. So, Bob?
Did you upset him today?
I apparently did. With Miles on quite a few albums.
Yes, I did.
What was it like working with him?
I enjoyed him tremendously. He and I got along very nicely. No quarrels. He had built a sort of bad story about himself being a heavy drinker. And drug use. The truth of the matter was that when he decided time to get left, he went home to his family's home, locked himself in,
He was a pretty prickly character with a lot of people, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. Most people were somewhat frightened of him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was a Huskyville.
Yeah.
And they have the easiest temperament.
Mm-hmm. But you got along with them well, and you did a lot of projects with them.
Yeah. I've often wondered why we got along so well.
Well, I showed a picture earlier. There was one reason. And I'm sure you treated him with respect like you would treat anybody, and that he treated you the same way. He treated you the way he was treated.
Absolutely true. I appreciate his musical ability. I appreciate him as a person because he told you he was going to do something, he would follow through and wouldn't ignore you.
All right. Now we're going to watch a movie that Frank was not involved with, and let me exit this here. And this is one from 1959 of Glenn Gould, who was also somewhat of a prickly personality. And you're going to get to know Glenn a little bit here. So I'm going to start this. And I'm going to go talk to Lars.
Long hair, or do you play jazz, or Bob Bebop, or what?
Oh, I'm the long hair variety.
Yeah, the long hair variety. Yeah. Oh, mm-hmm. Man, you must have a beautiful audience. They must be falling asleep at you.
Now a frequent visitor to New York, Glenn Gould first came from Canada to make his debut at Town Hall in 1955. It was a concert so successful that he was immediately put under contract by Columbia Records.
This is Fred Plout, who was another engineer like Frank was.
The first recording he made for Columbia was the enormously difficult Goldberg Variations of Bach, a now famous recording which became an immediate bestseller. 4 years and many recordings later, Gould is ready to put on tape and disc Bach's Italian Concerto.
What's the matter? Nothing wrong with the piano. You haven't played it yet. Well, I can't help to be here. All right. Well, that case, it shouldn't work this morning, but it does.
Well, maybe it's been stretched or shrunk. So how do you feel this morning? Any various aches and pains?
No. Specifically localized aches and pains. Just general lethargy.
We aren't going to get a good report.
It's a terrible thing to see, but you look bad today.
Killjoy.
Gould's habit of humming while playing causes a good deal of trouble to the sound engineers, and it demands great care to get a clean recording without extraneous noises.
Now, how do you want to do this? From the top? Well, let's just go from the top and see what happens. What'll happen is you'll play it beautifully. Bach Italian Concerto, take one. Boy, every kid in the world played this thing.
Twining,
sir.
My Twining.
Smoke, yes,
thank you.
Boy, that's strong. Did you put sugar and milk in there?
Can we hear that sound clearly?
Some pianists are at their best when they have the stimulus of an audience in a concert hall. Others, like Gould, prefer the recording studio.
In one bar, it changes tempi if you
know. Here, with recording director Howard Scott, he can listen to himself through playback and can repeat and repeat until he is satisfied he's produced a performance as nearly perfect as he can make it.
So what does he call him and tell him to send it to him? Yeah, his last check. They can send it, as long as he's in New York, they can send it right over to the hotel. Where are you staying, at the Westbury? Send it to the Westbury.
Listen to that just to find out.
Yeah, that was very good. Now, I don't know. I could play for you the one we did yesterday too as a comparison, which I think you better come in and play.
After you're worn out as a control man, you get less money, you become a musical director. Because the only thing you compensation you have is you can boss the guy that you were once doing, you know.
That's
what
you think. Yeah.
Well, that's what I think. I'm positive. I ask you to put in high end, and he puts in low. He does what he wants anyway.
More on the clarinets.
But,
all right.
And he takes it off.
So how do you feel about pictures?
Mustang.
Oh, you need them, yeah.
Don.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're here today. You don't think it'd be a good idea to get Glenn to at least put a scarf and some gloves on?
How about the
Are you kidding?
How about the gloves up on the piano?
Glenn, you know I never kidded you.
I've had quite enough of that sort of picture. We'll not.
Well,
no.
It's good enough for England and AP.
Well, the English press is, you know, the English press.
Well, if you get £21,000 or whatever it is out, I don't see why you should grab it.
Get back in the mood. We have to have tea. At least 5 minutes. At least 5 minutes.
Absolutely.
Hear that? Is it coming through?
Yeah, it's coming through.
Wait a minute. Oh, it's a question of how far forward you sit on it. That's what does it. Yeah. You sit at the front, it does it. Well, let's try anyway, see what happens. Bob, would you play that one back, please, this last take?
Say hi.
Will you play this take back, please, this last one we did? How do you feel?
It wasn't bad.
No, I think we've got it, yeah.
Got it. I don't know.
Take eight. Take five.
Take eight.
About 10,000 things we could talk about in that video. I'm not sure where to start. You mentioned if I recognize somebody in there. Oh, tell us who those people were that we saw. We saw Fred Plout.
Fred Plout. Howard Scott.
Was the producer. Bob. Who was
Bob
the,
Waller.
Right.
He was. His function was to operate the tape machine that recorded, and anything else that came along.
And Howard was there too? Chappie? I saw Chappie, I think.
Yeah, you did.
Howard Chapman?
Yeah.
Is that his name?
He was there early part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like he was sitting at the console. So I assume he also recorded part of it.
Was he the assistant engineer, maybe? And Fred, whoops, what are we out here? We're hearing something funny. I'm not sure what that is.
It's fixing.
Okay.
Call just dropped.
Okay. So Matt will work on that. And I see on the screen we've got a tracking problem. I'll work on that later. I didn't realize that was happening. Sorry about that for those in the room. People on the internet, I don't think are seeing that. So did you work with Glenn? Did you work with Glenn?
I did.
What kind of things did you do?
Whatever else came in for that.
Yeah.
Fred Plout usually did leave. Glenn Gould sessions. But there were times when...
Three. If you need something else, that's it.
Okay. So Fred usually did the sessions. But if he was busy or something, you would fill
yes.
in?
Yes.
Okay.
That would happen, Fred. We'd either go out of town or record someone else at 30th Street. And when that happened, then I was called on to fill in. I found it very stimulating, mostly because he's egocentric person. didn't think anybody else in the world deserved applause.
Where was he from? He wasn't American, was he?
No, Canada.
Fred?
Canada.
Fred was from Canada?
No, we were talking about Glenn Gould.
Oh, Glenn, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Matt, do you want to just mute those for now?
I think they're both online. Can you verify that they're on the phone with you, though?
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Steve and Dave?
Hi, Glenn. We were disconnected for a moment.
Okay.
Yep.
Sorry, folks.
It's all right.
We're going in many directions tonight. So, Glenn, do you have any further stories about him? Do you want to?
Well, there are very many of them, but they all.
What was the deal with the chair there?
Oh, it's a piano chair that his father had made for him. If you listen closely, you hear a lot of noise, creaks, and so on.
Mm-hmm. But he refused to play with any chair other than that one, right? Mm-hmm. So that was it. If you wanted Glenn Gould, you got him in his chair. All right. Let's talk about the console a little bit. This is still the old control room.
Yes.
What's the deal with this console? It's got rotary...
Rotaries.
...pots there. How many inputs was it? Do you remember?
At that time, I think it was 12.
12 inputs. Massive 12 inputs. The one we've got here tonight is 20. So. And this console that we're seeing is the same one that we saw in the video where you saw them making their tea on the console and pouring the sugar and milk on this very fancy and for the day device, very sensitive device. And it didn't get treated. I mean, it was a commercial piece, so it got used hard, right? Where would this console come from? This is not something you go down and buy in those days. Where did this console come from? Who made this console? Do you remember that?
I believe our own engineering department made the console.
And they did that for many years.
Yes.
I think every console we're going to see in this presentation was made by in-house by CBS.
Yes.
Which is pretty amazing. You don't see that anymore. Now you buy something. In those days, if you wanted it, you built it yourself. And you built it to suit yourself or suit your needs. So that was a very different day. And here's the original console with its comfortable chair.
Yes. It wasn't so comfortable.
What?
It always bothered.
Sitting there bothered you?
Well, I'd be sitting there 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah.
And no break or anything.
Right.
So, I think I still have the effects in my lower back.
Great.
I suffer all the time.
Now, this is actually a picture that I'm curious about. And Dave, I think you had this picture. Do you know where this came from? Dave Simons?
Yeah, the one with the chair there and the three CD meters. I believe it was. I got it straight from Sony.
Wow.
Back in 1999.
Yeah.
That's the first story of Frank.
And your book started around this time, right?
I mean,
not the writing of the book, but the story of the book, studio stories.
Right. It started basically with the opening of 30th Street.
Yeah. Is there anything that you want to share with us about that time period and that was notable about those days? I mean, the recordings are so clean and clear nowadays still.
I still have many people come up to me with a copy of Studio Stories to autograph and to find where they can get it. In New York, they only got it off Amazon. So right. They did it.
I did see it in a bookstore once, Frank.
You cut out there for a second, Dave. What did you say? You didn't...
Oh, I was said, Frank, I actually did see it in a bookstore once or twice.
Yeah, I think it's a popular book around here because of a particular resident. There's another view of the console and Fred's back looking through the window. And I think it's this picture is remarkable, if I can get up here, because of this mortised hinge that is no longer a hinge, and you wouldn't put a hinge on a window, but they must have used recycled lumber to build this wonderful control room for their flagship studio. So, and here's a later picture, a color one of the Brubeck Quartet with the old control room. And I've had people look at this picture and say, oh, yeah, that's really great. Look at how they didn't worry about leakage, and meaning that there's nothing separating the various instruments. They're very, very close together so they can hear each other. And that's nice, but... And here's another picture that is, I think, really showing a recording session. The other one was probably a publicity photo. And I put this one in here with the watermark in by Don Hunstein. And you recognized him in the Glenn Gould video, Frank.
Yes.
Who was Don? Who was Don Hunstein?
Well, Don was the official photographer for Columbia Records.
And pretty much every picture that we see of the interior of the 30th Street studio is one of Don's.
He covered just about every session that we had for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And he was always ready with his got some great pictures.
Mm-hmm. And Don is still active in New York. And
so he said.
Yeah, he's still going, and his pictures are available. There's this really great gallery in Manhattan called the Morrison Hotel Gallery that sells fine art music photographs. And just before we did our first meeting with Frank, 4 years ago almost now, here, they had an exhibition of 30th Street studio photographs, and they still sell all that stuff. So if you ever want to get anything like that, that gallery is a resource for Don's photos and others. So our next bit here, musical selection, is Percy Faith's theme from A Summer Place. And before you start it, this is about all I could find on it. There was no album... put out at the time, you know, theme from A Summer Place. It wasn't that. It was, this is Percy Faith's all-time greatest hits, and there was another one that was called Terra and Other Movie Melodies or something like that. And Summer Place was in there. But, man, that is such a giant smash hit that it was surprising to not see it with its own album. So we're going to listen to this. This was not something that you recorded. But it shows the sound of the 30th Street studio, and at the end of this we'll get Dave to talk about that a little bit. So, Bob? So, Dave, talk about that track and its sound, please.
Yeah. Well, when I was a little guy, listening to the radio, and anything was recorded in Columbia, well, particularly in 30th Street, came on the radio, particularly on AM, where the old radio profession really saturate the sound of that beautiful live echo here on that track and other that Frank did. My ears would pick up immediately. And it was around 99 or so, and I was writing for some music magazine, that I tried to find the guy who was responsible for some of that great sound. And that's when I found Frank at the phone book, called him up. And, as you know, Frank, I believe that Chappie is that one, right, Frank? Summer Play.
You cut out there, Dave. We didn't hear what you said.
Oh, yes. I believe that Chappie was the one who was on that track.
Oh, Chappie did that one? Did Chappie record that?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it sure has the Frank sound. And it really representative of what Frank and Mitch were doing at the time with those great records by the Percy was doing, Johnny Mathis, but of course Tony. And as Frank will tell you, the secret ingredient is the echo chamber. And that had a little bit of a delay on it. On that track, I'm sure Frank will attest to it, the sound of those, the shadow string. And when they're plucked, immediately hear that little bit of reverb that's coming out of that chamber, the echo chamber that they had in the building. And it was such a distinct sound. And that, it's one of the greatest sounds in recorded history. And it's what I think of when I think of Frank.
Yeah, and people who are not audio engineers, we should probably explain that nowadays when you want a reverb, you get an electronic device and you stick it in your rack and you run some signal in and you get some signal out and that's your reverb. Those days, they didn't have those kind of devices. So if you wanted to hear an echo chamber, you had to have an echo chamber. And so 30th Street was an old facility. It was an old building. It had been there for, 60 years, 60, 70 years by the time CBS got into it. So there was no echo chamber there. You relied on the sound of the room, and it was a big room, but not big enough to really give you some sustain, some lingering echo. So what did you guys do? Can you tell us that?
Well, yes, we rigged up some different systems whereby the tape machine feeding into the chamber to make the sound.
Yeah. Where was the chamber?
Chamber was down in the basement.
Oh, so you found a room or some space in the basement?
I started fumbling around.
Uh-huh.
And I opened up this door. Mm-hmm. And I looked in, I thought, really have something.
What was it? What was that room like? Was it? This was a solid building. So it was like concrete or stone or something.
Yes, both.
Uh huh. Oh.
But it did have kind of a 2-second. Layover of sound, and this is when it was full of old equipment and stuff.
When you found it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mentioned it to the brass and Mitch. So, well, send someone down, clean it out. This way we have somewhere to go. And that's what they did. Mm-hmm. It took a couple of days. But if I had been smarter, I would have taken the
All right, well, and Dave has made kind of a study of that echo chamber. How did they generate the sound, and how did they pick it back up, Dave?
Well, Frank told me that, speaking of echo, there's a wicked echo that I'm hearing. Is that because it's coming through speakers there?
We're not hearing it here, I don't think, are we?
I got a wicked delay. That's okay. It goes with the subject matter, right? I'll just deal with it. Actually, what I should do is I should go into my echo chamber, and that'll really screw everything.
Yeah, you'll see Dave's echo chamber later.
No, to answer your question, as Frank told me back when I first met him, it was just a 10 by 15 foot storage room, it said, with I think an 8 foot ceiling. And into it, they put a regular speaker. And then I think Frank eventually said it for a microphone. They had a Telefunken U-47 to send the echo sound back to the recording console, which was the basic principle for how all echo chambers operated. Columbia just happened to use the best microphone inside a basement. Pretty amazing.
Did that microphone stay the same throughout its duration, or did they have to change it out? Was it the same microphone, Frank?
Yes.
Wow.
And we would run tests on it periodically. And it just was fabulous. Never had a breakdown.
Because that's one of the most expensive sensitive studio microphones there is.
Yes.
Huh. Okay, great.
And that wasn't considered at first to be the one to use. But it's the only one that really gave us the kind of sound we wanted without equalizing.
Wow.
So. And that echo chamber was one of the signature sounds of the studio.
Yes, it was.
It's really recognizable.
Yeah, there are people coming from all over the world wanting to hear the echo chamber.
Do you remember some of the studio people who came from elsewhere? I think that EMI
came. And
which is where the Beatles recorded, because they wanted to replicate the sound of this 30th Street studio.
Yeah.
And they built their own echo chamber.
I'm sure you're right.
I've seen pictures of it.
I wasn't familiar with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Part of it.
Yeah. But isn't that something to come across the world to see an echo chamber down in the basement?
Except Frank never let them down there, though, did you, Frank?
Is that right? You never let them down there, Dave said? You didn't let them go down in the echo chamber?
No, I let those who were allowed to go.
Oh. Only the ones that were allowed to go went down there.
Well, you know, you're talking with the corporate.
Right.
Right.
Corporate secrets or something?
Not certainly secrets, but they're the corporate
property?
No, they're the mode of operation.
Oh, the way they do things.
Different.
Yeah, corporate secrecy and why cooperate with somebody else, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it was like a secret formula.
Right.
That they kept guarded. And it wasn't just the guy who'd been in England, also, like, there's other Gold Star Studio, which later became famous for their the Wall of Sound, Phil Spector had. They ended up building a great echo chamber. And that one, when I interviewed those guys, Dave Bold and Dan Ross, and those guys, they told me the same thing. They built theirs based on Frank's echo chamber. They were listening all through the system, trying to figure it out. They finally got something that they thought was close. The game of what it was, the Wall of Sound. So that, there again, based on formula they had for you.
What you're looking at now is not the normal position to record a fellow standing up. Bob Lawler was supposed to be in the back of the room making sure the tape was running properly.
Yeah, he might be giving Howard some tea or something. I can't quite tell what he's doing there.
Probably was.
Yeah. But you can see that we're standing in the studio looking up into the control room, and that door on your left is the only way in and out of the control room. So everybody who came in had to go squeeze past the producer there. The console is to our right a little ways, and the tape machines are further over. And I just put some pictures in here to show how cramped it is in this old control room. This is the Brubeck Quartet listening to some of the Take 5 sessions there. And when they were in there listening, everybody who was in there had to leave, I guess, because there just wasn't space. So at some point they decided that that is just not enough room for them, CBS decided. And so they built a new control room. And this is a floor plan of the studio, or an approximate floor plan, as best as I've been able to figure out by talking with a lot of people, of where things were. So the old control room is over here in this square, and this is not to scale at all. 30th Street is down here. The main entrance for people is over here through a single door on the 3rd Avenue side of the building. And you walk past the security guard's desk, and then you had a choice of walking through to the studio. And when we saw Glenn Gould walk in, he roughly followed the arrow down here. Or you could walk into a second studio, Studio D, which is very mysterious. I haven't seen much of any pictures of the inside of it. And I'm not even sure that... This is the location of it, but... The details of it are maybe not quite lost in the mists of time. There's a hallway down here where you could enter the new control room, which is over here, and I'll show you a picture of that in a minute. The big studio space, of course, is out here, and we'll come back to that in a while, but let me get rid of that. And this is the new control room over here. You can see where the old control room was there. And if we do compare pictures, if you look at this upper section of the wall, you can see where there were kind of church windows or something. And you can see this in the other picture, the picture you saw before of Glenn Gould practicing. And for a place that was... purchased and used under the premise of not washing the floors and not changing the curtains and not painting anything or doing anything to it, to go from this little control room on the end, which was still a substantial structure built into the room, because see, it doesn't go all the way up to the ceiling, but they took that out, painted it, and put in this new control room into the wall. So that had to have changed the sound a lot. And you've talked on a number of occasions, Frank, about how the sound changed when they did the floors and painted it.
Yeah. I had done probably the most recording time-wise at 30th Street. I'm pretty much locked into it. I love the sound. And when they finally did what Mitch wouldn't let them do, I had to do the first session when the studio came back to life.
You did the first session?
Yeah. And I turned the mic on and I couldn't believe it was the same. Absolutely no sign or sense of that the studio had originally. So I remarked to them about it. You can't figure it. You can't change it. So listen, you're all free. Come down. We'll play you a cut from the old control room set up. No, and you decide. Well, after many weeks, they finally agreed. And then that's when they decided they had to do something. So what do you do? The first thing we did was build a new console.
New console. To try to solve the sound problem? Okay.
Don't laugh.
Okay.
So when it was discovered to be true, a lot of press flowing in and out, and the decision was made. New control room would be moved further out. And months later, when the crew stopped coming in to do something, then we really had a chance to listen. So different. It was unbelievable. Mitch would not have been proud of his sense of hearing to know that he was right and everyone else was wrong.
Yeah, but that's the mysterious part of that, because Mitch was still in charge when this changeover took place. It happened sometime between 60 and 63. We know in 63 that it was done.
Yeah.
And the new control room was in place, and Mitch didn't leave till 65. So that's the confusing part. Looking at this studio has been really fascinating, because there are so many things that the closer you look at them, the less sense they make. And there's a lot of mysteries, which is kind of fun to...
Yeah, I'm sure you're finding it.
Yeah.
It is a lot of fun. It's interesting.
Yeah. And there was 20 years after it was remodeled until it was stopped being in business. So it wasn't like a last minute thing. There was from 49 to what, 60 is 11 years or 12 years that it was its old self, and then the next 20 were this new thing. So, and that's that about takes us to an intermission. And before we do that, I wanted to tell you and say how much fun it's been working on this with you, and with Dave, and with Steve, and this computer thing, which we're having a few issues with tonight, is amazing that we can share a screen. So everybody now who is looking at this on the internet and listening to us is seeing this thing here that we are looking at right now. And it's been a blast. And I've decided that I'm going to start a thing called Friends of the 30th Street Studio. This software that we're using is from this company, GoToMeeting.com, and I've got a free month subscription to it, and I'm going to renew it. I'm going to pay for a year and see if anybody wants to join and get together on a Saturday, and Frank is going to be the chairman of the thing. He said that already. And I'll get to be the president of it, and we'll meet on a Saturday afternoon, and people in Europe who wanted to take part in this, but it's 4 a.m. right now, are not taking part of it. And actually, I should talk now. This would be a good time to talk about the Steve Hoffman forums, who I ultimately found Steve Epstein through, and one of the moderators with it is here tonight, and it's this great forum where people from all over the world can post about music. And if you log into it, there's like 300 people at a time at any given moment when you log in. And the posts for today, every day, are like 12 pages long. So just today's posts cover 12 pages. So to get to yesterday's posts, you're going to page 13 or something. And there's a huge amount of information. And some of it is like, is Prince the greatest musician of all time? And other of it is the complete recordings of Tony Bennett, and that was like a 28 or 30-page thread about this $300 or $400 74 CD release from 2 years ago, I think it was, where people who are really, really into Tony Bennett and into the art of recording talk in great, knowledgeable detail about it. And the moderator, Matt, is here tonight. If you want to just say a couple words about it, and grab the microphone over there, Matt, please. But just tell us what this forum is and how it came about, and why is it such a great resource for people who love music?
Sure. The Steve Hoffman Forum is named after Steve Hoffman, who a lot of you audio geeks probably know as the guy who, if you go out to buy a gold-plated CD, he's probably the person that mastered the tapes. Or mastered that disc from the master tapes to get as good a sound as possible. And we have about 30,000 members on there. And like any internet group, there are some yahoos who come on there every so often, but most of them are pretty well-intentioned. And it's a fun place to go if you are just a music fan, or also if you're really into minutiae and details about different releases of recordings and how things were recorded. It's the type of place where if you want to know what that microphone is on the cover of that one album from 1963 and where the studio was, there are 25 guys in there who will answer that for you in 10 minutes. It's just a fun place to go and find out detailed stuff about recordings. That's what I do there mostly, is just trying to hunt down the kind of the historical aspect of things. But anything to do with music of all varieties, it's all on there. There's a huge classical music thread that's 30 or 40 parts of 1,000 posts each, and you can go through and find all kinds of things. Use the search engine while you're there, or else you'll just go crazy trying to plow through all the stuff. But stevehoffman.tv, it's a good place to go and make some friends.
And they are pretty, as internet forums go, they are pretty mild, really, as demeanored. If you go in there and start shooting your mouth off, that might be one thing, but if you're respectful and willing to learn, it's really been a wonderful thing taken part of. And I've met all of these great people and got a bunch of these pictures from it. So anyway, I'm going to do it here. It's going to cost me almost $500, but I'm going to do it for a year, and we'll see if it works. If you're interested in this kind of minutiae and arguing about it, and I'm going to start. I'm going to get Dave and Steve in for just a couple minutes here. We're running a little over our intermission time. This is a shot that was from the Glenn Gould video that's taken from above, looking down. So those lights that are way up in the air, we're looking way down on them. We're seeing almost all of the cord from them. Steve and Frank, how did somebody get up there? I've not seen anything. This is the only picture that I've seen from this perspective. Frank?
Yes, well, they have one very large ladder.
Mm-hmm.
It took two people slide it to the position that you wanted it.
Yeah. But this is way higher than any ladder is going to get you.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, to get to this lamp, you're 20 feet up in the air, and we're looking at least 20 or 30 feet of cable. This is where it's tied on to the up by the ceiling. So I just can't figure that this is a ladder. Steve?
The only thing I could think of is if they had a jib or a crane, but I don't think so. I don't think they had that kind of production for this.
Yeah, it's a mystery. I mean, how did you get up there?
Yeah.
Glenn Gould was over here. He walked the whole length of the room to get to his piano. And that picture looks like it's taken from about here looking down in the middle. I mean, even if you could get up in the wall up to the top, you're still 20 feet away from where that picture was taken. So isn't that crazy?
I can't envision any way of doing that from my memory of this.
Yeah, but somebody did it in 1959. Frank, you want to say something?
I'm going to say that at some point you got the arrow. Is that a walkway?
This here?
No.
Oh, up here?
No, down there.
Down here?
Go up to the next. Yeah.
Oh, that's a doorway. That's the double doors where the equipment came in. So the people came in, you said over here through the single door, and then this stupid thing is in the way, so I can't move it. But this is the double doors entering on the street, and then there was more double doors in here into the building. But the interest... No, now the screen is not showing this whole thing. I'm sorry, folks, you're not seeing the whole picture here. And I can't... let's see if I can make it a little bigger here. There we go. Is that... No, that's still not it. I can't make it smaller. I can only make it bigger. Let's get it bigger. Come over. I'll fix that at the break. The projector is having a problem with tracking. People on the internet are seeing that there's just a single wall there. There's not a double wall. There's no hallway or anything on the right east side. And that means that wall is tied up to the building next door to it, which was an apartment building. And we'll talk in the second half about the problems that caused.
There was also the telephone company. It was right next door.
Yeah.
And that was always kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
So we started cheating on them, get in there, figure out how to do the best we could.
Huh. So you better not tell any secrets here.
No.
It's illegal. Well, I guess the statute of limitations is gone. So you're safe. I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt you.
Now I was going to say, we spent a lot of hours spending time trying to figure, because there was no real blueprint to go by. So a few of us would come in one day and with pads and everything, we would be assigned one complete wall, find what's in there. And that's what we did for a long time.
And go exploring. I wish we had a copy of the results that you guys came up with.
Yeah.
That would be fascinating.
Maybe the engineering department has it.
Maybe. I don't know how to contact them, though. Well, it's past our time for our intermission. Let's take a break here. There's cookies, coffee, tea, and water back at the table in the corner. And thank you again for coming. This will be about 10 minutes, and during that time, there'll be a roll on the screen of Frank won the Audio Engineering Society's Honorary Member Award last year, and more than just being an honorary member. It's the highest honor our society can offer to somebody who is a member or non-member. The names of the people who previously won it are going to go by along with their accomplishments. And if you see some of them, it's going to blow your mind what it was. So thank you, and let's stop now.